spite of always saying no, someone needs no introduction, which would be true of Mortimer Kaplan, there probably is some point in reminding you of things that he has done. MC bears an interesting relationship to Miller Center, and while we would like even more involvement someday, why, Mortimer Kaplan has been the vice chairman of our fourth Miller Center Commission, which looked at the problem of, I believe, presidential disability, wasn't it, in the 25th Amendment. And we had the good fortune of meeting in his offices for those discussions. His major continuing interests have been fourfold: law, public service, teaching, and the educational process. And I ticked off a few examples of law: a graduate of the University of Virginia Law School, law clerk to U.S. Circuit Judge Armstead Dobie, practiced law in New York, professor of law really from the virtually the time that he left the service. Public service, seems to me, we almost all, when we think of the ultimate service, think of military, and in this regard, he had a very prominent role in the U.S. action in the world. He was a member of the initial landing force at Omaha Beach and cited for such, was a beach master, and played a very significant role. Secondly, he was appointed by President John F. Kennedy as U.S. Commissioner of Internal Revenue, served from 1961 to 64. And then he was a recipient of the Alexander Hamilton Award, awarded by the Secretary of the Treasury. He's had numerous responsibilities in the American Bar Association, Standing Committee on the Judiciary, Director and Vice President of Indigent Civil Litigation, and a number of major committees. Teaching, he's done it almost, I believe, continuously at the University of Virginia Law School, maybe with a few interruptions. Educational process, Board of Visitors, 92 to 97, University of Virginia Law School Foundation, and a number of other high responsibilities. Maybe the symbol of it all is when one visits the law school, one comes first to the Kaplan Auditorium, and now more recently to the Kaplan Pavilion. He's a patron of the arts, the Shakespeare Theater, Wolf Trap, and a number of others. So his interests in the broader aspects of education are very evident in his career. We're delighted that he would come and talk to us about the IRS. We've been looking forward to this for a while. He's had a few other responsibilities delayed it a bit, but we're delighted that he could be here this morning.
Thank you very much, Ken. This is very difficult to be among so many friends and have Ken go down the list. I didn't expect that. But it's always a real pleasure for me to be here. I try to find whatever excuse I can to come to Charlottesville. We brought up five children here, and then I was teaching, and little did I know that I'd have a student named Bobby Kennedy, and then Teddy Kennedy, and I'd meet Jack Kennedy as a senator, and lo and behold, the whole world for me was changed. I'd expected to come back to Charlottesville when it was over. In those days, the idea of public service was a privilege. I mean, to me, it was one of the finest privileges I had. And I think things have changed an awful lot since then. And rather unfortunately, public service is not given the respect and standing that it should have. And I'm hoping that there'll be a day, other than another war, to do this, to bring young, able people back to government, because we are the government, after all. I'm supposed to talk about taxes and tax collecting and all that, and as you know, the the tax collector has been the most despised, disdained creature since ancient times. The Sumerians had a phrase, you can have a lord, you can have a king, but the man to fear is the tax collector. But Edmund Burke, the great English statesman, said it more gracefully when he said, to tax and to please, no more than to love and be wise, is not given to man. And Mark Twain, of course, in his usual way, would say, the difference between a tax collector and a taxidermist is the taxidermist at least leaves the hide. But one of our lot did make sainthood. If one goes through the Bible, we find St. Matthew, who throughout is described as a publican, a customs collector. But that publican and tax collector was always coupled with the term sinner and harlot, if you go through. And it's been downhill, it seems, almost ever since. We haven't made that much progress. The IRS is always blamed for the extraordinary complexity of the tax law, the difficulties of compliance, and that horrendous tax return. And of course, the tax return merely mirrors the tax law. And if Congress talks about phasing out a particular deduction to reach a certain income level, the tax return has to explain it all. And so, struggle as they might, the personnel of the IRS really just have to just bear it, grin and bear it alike. The IRS has been criticized of late for the difficulty they've had with their computer system. And that one, I think they deserve some blame. I don't know why there haven't been more significant changes. I just got involved the other day on a $136 tax bill, which had been paid, and which had sent me a notice, resulted in a notice to me, where is your $136 plus $200 worth of interest, non-deductible interest. So we write back a letter, we give them the check showing both sides of the check and the forwarding letter and the certified mail and all this, and just 2 days ago I get another notice. Where is your $136 and now $250 worth of it? Well, I put my secretary on the phone and she just sat there and fast pressing, you know, all pressing buttons to get through, and finally gets a person, and they said, well, we're not the person to talk to, you have to talk to somebody else. So it's pretty tough, and I'm hopeful that more will be done. They've just announced that they're going to have a businessman who's an expert on computers head the IRS for the first time. It's always been a lawyer or an accountant with a tax background. It's going to be very interesting to see what it's going to be like to have someone who presumably has no tax background other than to pay his taxes, and he has made a lot of money. He's been a very successful businessman. And he's going to now try to run it. Now they're doing the research on him now, FBI, etc., but he seems to have a very good record. Then there are many people in terms of, you know, this criticism of the IRS. Many people have special agendas of their own. A lot of people are anti-government and they're anti-tax. So they're out there doing all sorts of things, criticizing the IRS. And you have those people who are pushing new tax systems. And that's a whole subject on its own, whether it's a flat tax or the USA tax,
plenty of room.
Yeah, the unlimited savings account approach, or a sales tax, or a VAT, value-added tax, all sorts of suggestions of changing the system, making it simpler. And then we even have those people who say, let's just end the IRS as we know it. Let's tear it out by the roots. Well, I suppose if we do that, we'll just wind up with an honor system of taxation, and which might work down at the university. I don't know. But I would hate to have just, you know, you just pay what you want to pay, what you think is your fair share. Now, the Russians have something like, they don't have an IRS in Russia. U.S. Treasury has been working with these European countries, particularly Russia and some of its, all the satellites around there. And they've been sending teams over there to help strengthen their system so they could become more dependent themselves. We did this down in South America during the years that I was in the IRS. President Kennedy had asked that I go to South America, and we had a huge conference, and I visited a number of the different heads of tax collection, and trying to help them help themselves so they can be self-sufficient in a way we wouldn't have to assist them with any sort of aid. And the same thing over in Europe now, in the old communist-controlled states. I know a number of my law partners have been going overseas and part of this program. Well, as I said, the Russians do not have an IRS, but they have tax police. And they wear some sort of a uniform. And they wear bulletproof vests. So maybe that's, I don't know whether the IRS as we know it is any better than that. But it wasn't always that bad. We have what is frequently referred to as the golden era of taxation, which just coincidentally coincides with my 4 years at the IRS. We had tremendous backing. I mean, President Kennedy really had a sensitivity to tax law. And maybe it was through his father that he learned all that. But he knew how important the tax law was to the strength of the country and the soundness of our democracy. I mean, because everything we want depends upon our ability to pay for it. I mean, we want Social Security to some people, some want Medicare, Medicaid, we want strong defense, we want a strong economic system, and where does it come from? Where does the money come from? We, as a member of the system, have to support it. And so Kennedy understood that, and almost immediately after he was elected, he appointed a task force on taxation, one of the first things he did. And he remembered his brother's former law professor, and so I was included in that task force. And it was a very interesting episode. There were about six of us, and one was a professor from Harvard, Stanley Suri, part of the best tax mind of this century, and a number of practitioners and political scientists. It was a group of six. And we had a short-range program and a long-range program. We worked on that just night after night, right up until the end of the year. This is between this election and the end of the year. And then we brought the report to him in Cambridge. He was making a speech before the Massachusetts House of Delegates up there. And we met with him in Arthur Schlesinger's home, and as we approached, we just saw this cordon of policemen and all that, and for the first time I realized the significance of what dealing with the president was. It was a very interesting time. I hadn't seen him in a while. He'd just gotten back from Florida, and he was all tanned and pacing up and down the room. It was really a sight to see. And he was really in tune with this tax program we're talking about. Remember his phrase, "Let's get America moving again." A number of people have adopted it since. And he didn't want the tax law to stimulate the economy. We put in something called the investment tax credit, and we reformed depreciation. He wanted to stimulate business as much as he could. At the same time, he wanted to end abuses, and we got into this travel and entertainment fiasco. We put in new roles, and we were accused of ending the American way of life, a tax deduction, entertainment, all this and that. And we were ending Broadway, plays were closing, blamed on the IRS and all this. And it wasn't the IRS, it was Congress who adopted some new laws. But nevertheless, we got strong backing from him, and I worked very closely with the Attorney General, his brother, Robert Kennedy, who had been a student for about, I came in his last year. And we work very closely together on using the Internal Revenue Service as a supplement to the organized crime drive. And we're very careful, particularly under the tutelage of Senator Harry Byrd, who was watching this quite closely, and with whom I had a very fine relationship. He was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, the most important committee so far as the tax collector is concerned. We had to appear before him. And so he sort of kept us things and helped keep things in balance so that we would not be subsumed by the Attorney General's office, which we weren't. I was very sensitive to that. But I like to quote Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes when I was commissioner, and during that period of time, as things were moving along so smashingly, Holmes had been approached by his law clerk who said, "Isn't it terrible we have to pay these taxes?" And Holmes said, "I like to pay taxes. With them, I buy civilization." Well, that's a very deep thought, and there are not too many people who really like to pay taxes. But I must confess the taxes were very low at that time when he said that the rates were the burden wasn't what later became what it is today. When I went back to practice, I more frequently quoted Judge Leonard Hand, and he said, "There is nothing sinister in so arranging one's affairs as to keep taxes as low as possible. Everybody does it, rich or poor, and all do right, for nobody owes any public duty to pay more than the law demands. So there's nothing wrong with arranging your affairs efficiently, as long as you're honest and intelligent and don't put things under the bed." Senator Bob Dole had another way of putting taxpayer attitudes. He says, "There are a lot of people who don't like to pay taxes, especially those who never try." And I suppose the mission is of the IRS to make sure you try and to try even harder. Now, I was asked to talk about some myths and realities, and I'll just pick out some, and then we'll open this session to questions. One, and I've told this before, the question is, is the IRS commissioner or other top officials of the government exempt from examination of tax returns? Well, the answer is a resounding no. Even the president gets audited. And I remember right next to my room in the IRS building, we had a great big safe with the tax returns of all the presidents of the United States, going back to Woodrow Wilson. And I was never curious about them. I had the right to look at them, but I didn't. The only returns I did see were President Kennedy's return, which would be sent in when he filed, and usually had a special revenue agent look at it. He got examined every year. I don't remember being examined while I was there, but right before I was appointed as commissioner, I was going through this intense audit in downtown, and I used to consult with what was then known as Perkins, Battle, and Minor. It goes back a few years. It's now McGuire, Woods, and Battle, I believe. And the revenue agent was there to examine my return. And we were going down item by item, every single day, all my checks. It was a real workout, and the phone rings. And it's a call from the White House saying that that afternoon they're going to announce my name as Commissioner of Internal Revenue. And the question was very clear what was going on, and I hung up, the revenue agent, a fellow named Clint Anderson, and he said, "Mr. Kaplan, I feel silly." And I said, "Go on, Clint." This is after 3 hours together. "Go on, Clint, do your job." And well, in 30 seconds we were through. And a few weeks later I got a letter of commendation from the then district director on my record keeping. We promptly sent him out to Cincinnati, as a matter of fact. And life went on. But they do audit on whatever system that they're particularly following at that time. And there are no exceptions. Do they maintain a blacklist? The answer is, again, no. But we did go through a history with President Nixon at the time where he did have an enemies list. And that resulted in the firing of two commissioners who refused to audit the returns of his so-called enemies list. And George Shultz, who was the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, he backed these commissioners up very much. And they did not go forward examining that enemies list. The recent release of the Nixon tape just the other day, tape number 48915, if anybody's interested, reveals his attitude. The aides were asking what sort of person he wanted to fill some of these empty posts. He says, "I want to be sure he is a ruthless son of a bitch that will do what he's told." And these fellas wouldn't, the fellas they had on board. Well, actually, the IRS is careful to be neutral and non-political. They're under the gun. There's the basic tradition, and for a few aberrations back in ancient times, they've been pretty good at that. They're trained that way, and the policy has been consistent both under both parties. So individuals can rest assured that, you know, it, despite locker room stories that you hear and coincidences, people who've had certain run-ins sometimes with the government say, gee, they've examined my returns. There can be, the IRS does watch the newspapers. And I do know that when certain people were called up for, I remember Bobby Baker, who was a very important person in the administration of Lyndon Johnson. And he'd come out of the Senate where he had been a member of the staff. And there was some great big scandal. And I had a staff meeting. I said, I want to make sure we're on top of that. What's the story about Baker's returns? Now, he had been accused of whatever it was, bribery or something of that sort. And so that sort of thing would be an exception to that general statement I made where they just follow basic rules. They do not ignore newspapers. They do not ignore so-called lifestyle, where, and they've been criticized for that at times, but they feel that's part of their job. Ideological entities, that is something which is very sensitive, and you read about that in the paper. Left-wing or right-wing organizations, they sometimes abuse their exemptions. They get tax exemption, and they do things they shouldn't be doing. They're not supposed to engage in political activities. If you are what we call a 501c3 charitable organization, educational, religious, they're all that category for which people get tax deductions. They are not permitted to engage in any political activity. And so when you start finding out they're doing that, then they get examined. They sometimes will attack one president or another. And President Kennedy did make speeches about the need of not abusing the tax exemption, and we would react to what would be a presidential policy. And he was criticizing the right-wing organizations. So we met and said, now look, we just can't go after right-wing organizations. This is the president's policy. We have to balance this out. Well, we had difficulty in finding left-wing organizations because President Eisenhower, during his 8 years, his administration had given them a tremendous going over. They'd been really losing exemptions and paying additional tax and the like. But we did scrape the bottom of the barrel and find some. But that's the only place where you do find some political flavor getting into the picture. But it's not any individual. And the commissioner realizes that he's going to have congressional scrutiny, oversight. He just can't willy-nilly go in there. The common way of picking returns for examination is through something they call DIF, Discriminant Function System. It's DIF, I think, stands for just that. They try to pick out returns which have unusual characteristics, also as a ratio they're playing with. And they're looking for returns which have a probable error in them. Most productive returns, as they call them. most productive returns, those that can produce deficiencies if they're examined by the IRS. If you get a higher return, you have the highest probability of error, therefore they're going to pick out that return. Then there is the information return matching, which identifies returns that haven't reported. These 1099s you get, you really can almost thank Senator Harry Byrd for that. I had asked him if he would support a withholding tax. You really collect through withholding, believe me, if you're running the IRS system. You know, withholding on your salaries, I mean, 97-98% of salaries are all reported. We wanted withholding on dividends and interest. And I met with Harry Byrd, and he said, now look, he said, I've never received more mail on an issue than on that one. He said, I know the banks have been simulating, they've been sending out forms. He said, but nevertheless, the mail is, you're just not going to get it. He said, what can I do next for you? Yeah, I said, what about, we're trying to put in a computer system. Incidentally, the IRS is still using that 1961 computer system we put in, with a few patches here and there. I said, we need account numbering. And there was great opposition to that. A lot of people didn't want taxpayers of America to have a number. And he nevertheless supported account numbering. We needed a number because there are too many Robert Smiths and Bob Smiths, R. Smith. And if you had a number, and that's why our Social Security numbers are being used. So he got up on the floor of the Senate, and he made a very strong speech on behalf of that, and the Congress went along with it and made it part of the computer system. But that information return matching, 1.2 billion pieces of paper, think of that, 1.2 billion are matched against returns. The Congress pushed the IRS to keep on increasing that matching. At one time, they only matched maybe, they started off with about 25%, then 50%, and then Congress really pushed them on that real hard. You got us to give you account numbering, and we're sending out all this paper now. Make sure you match all this. And I think they're right on that. And Congress is again searching for more areas. It's not only dividends and interest where you have this, real estate transactions, pension payments, annuities. They all have information, 1099s, identified with them. Does the IRS get a commission out of all this stuff, all the money they collect? No, they got to turn that all over to the Treasury. They've got to go up and get their appropriation like any other agency in government. And the Congress is pretty tough on them. Even though the IRS said, look, for every dollar you give us across the board, we'll just from practice, we bring in 6 to 1. That's easy. If on our revenue agents, we bring in 10 to 1. Now, that's pretty good business if you're thinking just as business. But the Congress, you know, they pat you on the back, you're doing a great job, but then they'll cut back very severely. And frequently it's just political. I remember Lyndon Johnson did not want to have a budget that was over, listen to this, $100 billion. Today it's $1.4 trillion. From 1964 until now, it's $1.4 trillion from $100 billion to show what's happened in our lifetime. Johnson didn't want to get over he didn't want to be the first person to have a $100 billion budget. So they shaved everything down. They cut down on appropriations, even though they knew they could get 10 for 1, let's say, on revenue agent dollars. So we wound up with 99.6, something like that. but you also have congressmen who do not want enforcement. I've heard a congressman say, when you people enforce that law so much, all I get are complaints from my constituency, and I don't want these complaints. So they don't want too many policemen on the beat, so to speak. Let me turn to another question here. Can a revenue agent impose a tax or collect a tax or put a lien on your property Does he have the power to do that? Well, the answer is no. When that revenue agent comes in to examine your return, he has all sorts of constraints on him. You're not subject to collection or liens unless there's an assessment, a formal assessment. All he can do is propose. That's an important thing to know. Most people, you know, they feel, well, my goodness, the world's at an end, and the minute that revenue agent comes in and he finds I've got to come up and ante up those dollars right away. You do not. In the first place, the revenue agent must give you some notice that he's coming in. He can propose that tax, but you have all sorts of appeals, all sorts of rights in which to have some supervisor of his, or actually an independent agent known as an appeals officer, listen to your case. And this takes months and months and months. If you really want to delay, you wait for something called a 90-day letter, which is sent to you. They have to send a 90-day letter before they can assess. After all this farrah-dirah with the revenue agent and taking your appeal, they cannot assess until they send you a 90-day letter, which says, unless you agree and pay your taxes in these 90 days, we're going to assess you. Okay, now during that 90-day period, you can file a piece of paper with the tax court of the United States Tax Court, which is very simple, actually, and hold the thing up indefinitely. So there's a 90-day so-called grace period where you can ultimately challenge that assessment. And it won't be assessed. The assessment is held up until after all the court proceedings are over. It could take years and years. Now, the negative part is interest is running against you all the time. And the rate right now is 9%. And unfortunately, the interest is non-deductible. It used to be deductible. And why they don't allow that deduction, I really feel very strongly about that. I've written about that. I've spoken to senators about that. But it was part of the famous 1986 Revenue Act when they were trying to raise some more money. There's no rationale for that, because lots of times the delay is due to the IRS itself, and that interest is running against you. And I feel you should be allowed to deduct that interest. You cannot. A business can, but an individual cannot. A business can, but an individual cannot. I said all this thing about this no liability to payment of tax until you're assessed. There are two exceptions. There are always exceptions. One is the so-called jeopardy assessment. If the revenue is being jeopardized, you got a little black bag and you're heading for the border, the revenue agent, the revenue service is not stopped. They can make this so-called jeopardy assessment and assess you and grab that black bag as you're going across the border. So that jeopardy assessment, and those are extreme cases. Revenue agent can't just make a jeopardy. He'd have to go to a supervisor and say, this guy is gambling at Vegas and he's doing something. We've got to collect this money. You've got to be a real believer and have an awful lot of facts. Then there's a so-called termination assessment, where they can terminate your tax year right in the middle. It may be that Mexican case where they haven't even examined the return and they know, take a drug dealer who's going for the border, they can end the year, you know, on June 25th and say, okay, that's the end of the year, January to June, we're going to assess you right away in order to protect the revenue. Those are very extreme cases. The average person never runs into that. My experience as a boxer at the University of Virginia, which is probably the most important thing I did while I was there, again, I didn't want you to mention it, but actually when I was appointed commissioner, that was more important than anything else in my record. They felt that was quite appropriate for an IRS commissioner than a boxer. But one of the first things that confronted me was the famous Johansson-Patterson fight. Ingemar Johansson was one of the boxing champions, and he was fighting Floyd Patterson for the world's heavyweight title. And there was only one title in those days. Today they got about six different titles in each class. And it was a very big fight. Johansson was a Swede. He had formed a Swiss corporation, and he was alleging there was a treaty between the United States and Switzerland, and he was a bona fide Swiss citizen, he claimed. And he claimed that he was not subject to taxation on his services in the United States on a temporary basis. Nevertheless, a court had ordered him not to ship any money out of the country until he settled his tax matter. And he was violating a court order, and he was secretly sending money over to Sweden, his home, real home. And we found out about that. And there he was fighting. He was going to get several hundred thousands of dollars. We thought that was an appropriate time to start collecting the taxes. And we planned to go in and seize the gate receipts down in Florida that night. And I was worried. We were going to go there before the fight, and my staff is looking at me. Would Johansson fight if he knew his gate receipts? He wouldn't fight if he seized the gate receipts. And I made a soul-searching judgment that he would. And we did go in, and we seized the gate receipts that night. And Johansson should have stayed in bed because he was knocked out. Patterson won the title and went on for another bout with Sonny Liston. And the same sort of thing was happening again. A guy named, there was an organization that publicized its tax plan. It was going to have a tax plan. You ever hear of Roy Cohen? He was one of the co-promoters of the fight. And Roy Cohen, who was an infamous figure, got a lot of publicity, and they told how they were going to avoid their taxes. Well, we couldn't stand still on that. Again, but this time, there was a lot of closed-circuit television was going on. And the real money was in the theaters, 200 theaters around the country. So we synchronized our watches, and right after the fight started, throughout the country, we had 200 collection offices go in and seize the receipts, protecting the revenue. Well, this was a rather extreme example of an exercise of federal power. And you can imagine all the noise that came out of Congress. But I had gone to see, before each instance, Senator Harry Byrd, chairman of the Finance Committee, Wilbur Mills, Ways and Means Committee, my Appropriations Committee, both Republican and Senate. I brought them and told them exactly what we were going to do. And they at least didn't object. And when people got up on the halls of Congress and started saying this was a terrible exercise of federal power, immediately these bishops would stand up and say, now, wait a minute. The commission consulted with us. They like to say that. And what he did had our approval, et cetera, et cetera. And I learned an awful lot about how Washington worked just through that one incident. Well, let me just take one more item. Should you always cooperate with the IRS? They come in there and they want to examine your return. Well, the answer is yes and no. Most of the time, it's yes. And it's not necessarily because of any extreme patriotism. The truth of the matter is our Internal Revenue Code statute has given them enormous authority. They have a summons authority. They've got to give you 10 days notice. They give you a piece of paper right away and say they want to examine all your books and records, and they want to interview you. They have the right, specifically under the statute, to do that, to examine all your books and records and to go to third parties, again in the statute, and examine anything pertaining to you and examine individuals or corporations and find out. So should you cooperate? Well, with those powers, I'd say, you know, what else is there to do? Now, at times, we have taken on, I should tell you that I practice law now, and we have 50 tax lawyers, and all we do is deal with the IRS, and we're fighting them most of the time. or trying to resolve issues or get rulings or plan transactions. So in a way, within reason, we are adversaries on issues when there are disputes like that. And at times, we have challenged the use of these administrative summonses when we feel they've been too broad and too extensive, things of that sort. The exceptions to that would be if somebody walks in the room with a nice blue suit, and a white shirt, and a modest tie, and shows you a nice gold card or a gold badge, and says, I am a criminal investigation officer, CID. I'm a special agent, or maybe he says, I'm a special agent. He's a very nice man. Well, that person has only one job, to look for criminal activity. And that special agent, his motivation is really to put people in jail for violation of the tax law. Not so much to collect that amount of money, but to make an example, like Leona Hemsley, you know, she was charging everything off to the business, to make an example to the world, to have an impact. With that person, I would react very differently. And you can always claim the Fifth Amendment. And you can also, a lawyer-client privilege on things you may have discussed with your lawyer in general, related to taxes. I don't want to get any refinements on that, but those are two particular areas where one, and I would say I wouldn't want to talk, I don't want to talk to you anymore about this. I want to bring my counsel into this. And there's nothing to do about that. You're entitled to have counsel. So if there is a gold badge and criminal investigation officer, then I would not cooperate. But that's the rare case. I mean, the overwhelming number of cases are basic civil audits where there are no alternatives. Well, why don't we stop at that? Let me just say this, that it's been said that our taxes reflect a continuing struggle among contending interests for the privilege of paying the least. And Senator Russell Long, who used to be chairman of the Finance Committee after Harriet Byrd, says, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree. But I should say, despite the pockmarks in our system, we do have the most effective tax system in the world. And people come from all over the world, tax administrators, to study our system. And it's one of the major regions where we're as strong as we are as a nation. And so, you know, whether we like it a lot, this is something that's one of the responsibilities of having the privilege of living in this country under this form of government. But there's no question that we need major tax reform. There are lots to be done. And I think that the rumination that's been going on right now is very healthy. Personally, my view is I know the appeal of the so-called flat tax, and that requires a lot of definition when you talk about flat tax, and this USA tax and the like. I'm generally in favor of a broad-based income tax with very much lower rates. I'd eliminate all exceptions, all special rates and privileges. I would treat all types of income alike. And you'd get your simplification that way. Eliminate as many deductions as you can. I mean, the ones that stick out, the difficult ones, are the charitable contributions and the interest on home mortgages. Those two are very difficult. And one might have to give way on those two items in this type of system. But you would have a very simple return with it. And so, again, I should say that I'm basically optimistic about the future, and I'm confident that this nation will prosper and grow whatever tax system we have, and regardless of what Congress tries to do. Senator Russell Long had a statement on that too, and I'll end with that. He says, no matter how hard we in Washington try to screw the country survives. And with that, I'll stop.
anyone not in shock is free to ask a question.
Yes, sir.
Regardless of how one feels about the appropriateness of taxing capital gains, how can anybody rationalize taxing that part of it that is due to inflation? There are so many people who use it as a method of saving, investing in stocks over 20, 30, 40 years that they can't afford to sell because of the inflation portion of it.
I'll say this, I do think there's going to be a capital gain change this year. I think the momentum has built up. The question is, what about capital gains? Because there is an inflation factor built in. And that really is the real reason why capital gains have been treated differently. There was a time during the Reagan years when they treated capital gains like other types of income. They reduced the rate down with the maximum rate of 28%. Now, the question basically is, if you had a rate, let's say, not more than 25%, would you be willing, if everything would be taxed at 25%, would you be willing to accept that, notwithstanding the point that you make about the inflation factor?
Well, if my rate were under that rate, I wouldn't be.
Regular
rate.
There is a big argument to be made there because of this inflation factor. The compliance problem of putting in an indexing for cost of living increases would be horrendous. Think of a mutual fund where people are putting in contributions, let's say every month or every few months. You would have to index every single item. The compliance problem would be just horrendous. And I don't think indexing is going to make it. I do think we're going to have a lower rate for capital gains. I hope that Congress doesn't get tied up with making special categories. Once you start talking, a family business will be taxed so much, real estate will be taxed this way, and secured registered securities of listed companies will be treated another way. I think then you get all sorts of game playing. People try to squeeze activities into categories, and it gets complex. I would like to see across the board reduction in the capital gains under our present system. Now, if I was starting anew and they asked me to write a whole new system, I might not go with you.
Next question.
Yes.
Mr. Garnett.
As you referred to 501c3.
C3 status.
In relation to political activity.
Right.
So 501c3 is supposed to be a charity and non-political.
Right.
But is it not true that 25% of such an institution's revenues can be utilized in political activity?
You have public charities. Public charities can make a certain, as opposed to private foundations.
Well, I'm just referring to any charity.
The law makes a big distinction between so-called public charities, which might be a church, a university, and private foundations. And there are literally millions of private foundations. And private foundations are severely limited. Public charities can engage in certain types of political activity, but it's very, one has to make an election, and it's tightly controlled. But you're right.
The 25%.
I don't know whether 25 is the number, but right.
Well, my point in that regard is that because of that allowance, within the 501c3 category, then in order to really enforce that, every institution, every charitable institution would have to have detailed auditing.
But I should say this, it isn't supporting particular candidates. You can't support particular candidates. You can take positions with that money. You can't say I'm for, candidates X or Y. There are severe limitations on it.
Oh, I see.
Because
I think there is possibly a lot of abuse
in
that area.
Well, that's why there's been this, these ideological examinations that each president has gone through. Yeah.
Is the IRS prepared for the big glitch in 2000?
Yeah, they're working desperately, believe me. And this man they brought in is, I can't call his name, but it's been in the newspapers a lot the last couple of days.
Rosati,
yes. He's running a big computer organization. I know one of the people affiliated with that. They were McNamara whiz kids. They're very bright people. And I know the IRS has been dealing with this extensively. It's a big problem.
Jim Garnett.
Mr. Kaplan, there's been a lot of criticism of the IRS recently for the management, not so much the tax law, but for their interim and administration, particularly in regard to bringing the new system up.
Yeah.
There's a proposal apparently out to take the IRS out from under the Treasury Department and put it under supervision of an independent board or council or whatever. Does that give you a
They're going to come out. One of the proposals, this is the restructuring commission that has been appointed, and they're going to come out with a report within the next couple of weeks, I believe. They've been examining, it's bipartisan. Senator Kerry and Congressman Portman are the co-chairs. And they have been making an extensive study of this thing. I appeared before them with other ex-commissioners. Secretary Rubin of the Treasury has had meetings with all of us, and they're sort of competing plans. One of the proposals of that restructuring commission was to spin off the IRS completely and to make it an independent agency, as opposed to merely being a bureau of the Treasury Department. That one is not going to make it. I just think the committee is too tied up on it. I don't think they're going to come out with a spin-off. But what they have asked for, and I think the point you're making, is to have an independent board of directors really act as, I would say, almost run the IRS. If they're going to function like a board of a business corporation, they would have ultimate control. Now, the commissioner would be appointed by the president for a 5-year term. If they felt he wasn't doing the job, all they can do is sort of complain to the secretary, and that could be just disregarded. In other words, up to the president to make up his mind. But there's going to be a real hassle as to whether or not there should be an independent board. Now, I've met with Senator Kerry and Congressman Portman, and they said all we want them to do is really to supervise that budget, not get into the day-to-day management. Well, if you control that budget, I mean, you can tell the IRS where to go. And for example, there is a phrase which just makes my skin crawl. They call it customer service. Now, come on now, you know, how far do we want to go? Customers, you know, the idea that we're customers, you know. I just think it's a very inappropriate term. It crept into the language 5 or 6 years ago. And this report is going to be plastered with that. We want more customer service. Now, I think in terms of really serving, you know, being helpful to taxpayers and making their job as easy as possible and being courteous and fair with them, those are very essential things, very important. But they might allocate everything to that. You know, have bridge parties so you can explain during coffee break what the tax law is all about, things like that. Clients, compliance is very important. And I do think that most people pay their taxes the way they should pay them. It's only a small percentage that really beat the game. And I think it's owed to everyone here that the neighbor down the street is paying their proper share. Now, I can do this in a fair, decent manner, that's all. And my one criticism with that restructuring commission is that they have not talked about compliance at all, about encouraging people to meet their obligations. I do not think there should be an independent board. I do think there should be more oversight by the Treasury. I do think they should bring in a board of advisors who have their say. And I would have a bipartisan board of advisors who are given a real hearing and can and be as critical as they can. But I think having the Secretary of the Treasury of the picture is important. It was put to me whether I wanted the IRS to be independent. I like the idea of having a cabinet officer who was close to the president, who could take my problem right to the president and I know it would be heard. Secretary Dillon, Douglas Dillon, was the secretary when I was there. He was a very important man in government, very well respected. I felt I had an ally there. So, yes, more oversight. I think the Treasury used to permit the IRS to do its own thing with hardly any interference at all. I think the Treasury ought to be more involved on it, and I do think there should be an outside advisory board, but not an independent board.
A few more brief questions.
Right.
I want to find out, what are your views in regard to proposed changes in estate taxes?
Estate. Yeah, that has a lot of social implications. The estate tax is primarily a leveling process, not so much a revenue-raising process. Of late, they have raised, I think they raised close to 15% of our revenue. I may be high on that. I think the tax rates are too high on estates. I mean, they go as high actually as 60%. It's a 55% ceiling, and there's an extra 5% as you go above $10 million, and they really claw back the lower rates they gave you down below, so that you ultimately would pay a flat tax of 55% on a very big estate. I think that's wrong. I mean, I'm against any taxes that ever takes more than 50% of one's earnings, and I think estate taxes are the wrong way of getting this leveling process. We have to have some. It has been suggested that in lieu of an estate tax, we have a capital gains tax on all appreciated property at death. That all your unrealized appreciation should be taxed as a capital gain tax if it's a capital asset. In lieu of an estate tax. Now you think about that. And maybe you want to look at your own portfolio to figure out which way you're better. But I do think we're going to see, I don't know if we have a lowering of rates. I would like to see some. I do think we'll see an enlargement of the lifetime exemption, the 600,000 lifetime exemption, husband and wife, it's $1.2 million. That hasn't been changed since the early 80s. And I think that will go up probably over a period of years, you know, increase at 50,000 a year, maybe even as high as $1 million or $1.2 million per person.
Any other? You had a question, yes. brief question.
What do you think of the marriage tax?
Professor Edwin Cohen of our law school has made numerous studies of that. And they say it's impossible to eliminate a differential in the marriage status unless you're going to take the single person and disadvantage them.
Well, you had the 1969 tax laws,
yes,
which put a penalty on the working married couple.
Yeah.
Then there was one phase in there where you had a $3,000 tax adjustment.
Yeah.
And then 1986, they removed that and made it even worse.
Yeah.
But I think that any 12th grade student could come up with a system of making it fair. Virginia has a very, very good law as far as taxes are concerned.
Which is what?
You can file as an individual, you can file jointly, you can file a return with each one listing their own income, and you're taxed at the lower rate.
We used to have that. It started out that way. And then there were objections from the single person community that they were being
added. But this does not hurt the single person.
Yeah.
I was testified before the House Ways and Means Committee in 1972 when Mr. Cohen made his statement.
Yeah.
And I remember he said the main reason for it is to get more revenue.
Well, I tell you what, there's a book that just came out, and I would recommend it to everybody by someone called Michael Gratz, G-R-A-E-T-Z. He used to teach here, he teaches up at Yale now, where he devotes a full chapter to that issue. And he says it's impossible, really, to make it dollar for dollar even. But I know what you're talking about, and I think there ought to be some adjustment, even if it isn't the exact dollar, but to attain parity.
Right.
Do individual auditors have quotas? You speak about 10 to 1. Do the individual auditors have quotas, or is that just the organization?
No, I'm glad you raised it. That's one of the things that I just didn't touch on. They used to have quotas in the old days. When I came on board, I visited offices, and they had charts, like raising funds, you know, little red charts with a thermometer type thing, just showed how much each revenue agent had proposed in deficiencies. And I put an absolute stop to that and prohibited group supervisors from keeping that individual book on individual agents. Statistically, you really have to know your numbers, though, as you go before. And we had statistical numbers, but we really wanted them evaluated on a quality basis, professionalism, how fair they treated taxpayers. They were urged to point out deductions, and we would get letters at times from taxpayers. It's much harder to evaluate people, but they do not have quotas. This has persisted over the years.
Yeah, I was audited 2 years in a row when I was at Yale and built a house in Vermont for a ski resort. That was a hot subject right then.
Yes. Yeah. What year was that?
1969, 70.
Well,
Nixon's in
that. Yeah, right.
The second time I was audited, I felt so sorry for this nice man. Yeah. He tried to find something and he couldn't find it.
Yeah.
And I had some substantial checks to a Dr. Wilson. Yeah.
Well, you know, there are, you know, these agents go through training, and the bulk of them do a pretty good job. You do get a few who have this policeman on the beat attitude and who are out there to have something. You know, you have to understand this. The agent is really not the final arbiter in these things. His instruction is that if the government has a significant position, he may think you're right, but you know, maybe you're 51% right. He's supposed to leave that up to the appeals officer. And that's why they have this appeal, and in any significant cases, I mean, you get a much better result with appeals. And the agents call they propose a deficiency. They write you a letter, your deficiency is so much. That's only a proposal. If you go to the appeals officer, you normally, if you have some backing on what you've got, can reduce that. The revenue agents refer to the appeals officers as the gift shop. They feel they give it all away. And statistically, I mean, the dollars that are assessed are notably lower than the amount of the revenue agent's deficiency, proposed deficiency.
Well, I guess we've come to the end of our hour now, so we thank you very much.
Okay, right.